Everybody has at least one. They are part of our identity and cultural heritage. They convey our emotions, ideas, and histories. They connect us and they separate us. These are the languages we speak. But in a diverse, ever-changing, ever-moving urban environment like New York, languages jump, they mingle and weave, they evolve, and sometimes they fade away. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. In this podcast, we hear from those who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. Our guest today on What's Your Map is on a mission to map some of the world's most at-risk languages in the most linguistically diverse city in history, New York. Ross Perlin is an American linguist, writer, and translator, and he's the co-director of the Endangered Language Alliance. His book, Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues, traces the waves of immigration that shaped New York's linguistic landscape. He follows six extraordinary, everyday speakers of endangered languages into the heart of their communities, revealing how they are working to preserve their languages against all odds. Ross, thanks so much for joining us today on What's Your Map? And what is the map that we're going to be looking at?
Thanks so much for having me, Jerry. This is the Languages of New York City map, the digital version. There's also a print version we could discuss, but it's at languagemap.nyc. And it's a decade-long attempt here at the Endangered Language Alliance to map what we believe is the most linguistically diverse city, not just in the world, but in the history of the world, contemporary New York.
And just take me into this map, because it's not a traditional map as we might think of it with contour lines and trig points. It's more what we might call a thematic map. Tell me a little bit about it. What are we looking at?
It is an experiment. As far as we know, nobody has tried to map the linguistic diversity of a city before. Mapping languages itself, as we could discuss, has a lot of complexities. Languages move in the mouths of their speakers or the hands of their signers. They're not things that can easily be pinned down to a map. And moreover, the impetus for this was that official data, such as the Census Bureau collects here in the U.S., but really you could say this almost for any other country in the world, does not capture linguistic diversity, even a fraction of it. So official data here really finds at most in New York, coming from the Census Bureau, something like 200 languages at most. We've mapped over 700 here. So it is a thematic map that tries to tell the story of this linguistic diversity historically in the metropolitan area, and also particularly by elevating the languages which are otherwise completely invisible, the primarily oral, endangered, minority, and indigenous languages which otherwise people don't realize are here at all.
And it is amazing. I've been playing around with this, and I should say that we're probably going to talk quite specifically about areas of New York, because I've lived in New York in the Lower East Side. So just to visualize, I guess, what we're looking at, we see this map which shows, as it were, the finger of Manhattan. And then to the right, you've got most big area of Brooklyn. And across this, you have dots, these multicolored dots, which you are mapping different languages, Ross. And I just find it utterly beguiling, because then you can click onto any of these dots and you can come up with languages. I haven't actually clicked one yet with a language that I know. I mean, this is kind of, it's extraordinary.
It's a good sign.
It's an extraordinary.
As it should be.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So tell me a little bit more about what we're looking at. I guess my first question is, with the concentration of languages, is probably Manhattan. We see greens and blues and reds and grays, all kinds in Manhattan. But is there anything particularly that we're noticing that's significant about these clusters of languages?
So the first thing that hits you is this sort of sea of dots, right? Centered on the New York archipelago. It really is an archipelago. We forget that with all the bridges and tunnels, but actually it's dozens of islands, a few of which, of course, like Manhattan are famous, and Brooklyn and Queens belong to Long Island, and there's Staten Island. So you see all these dots. Actually, there are really over 1,200 of them. And, you know, at first it just looks like, wow, that's a lot of languages. What does this actually mean?
Yeah.
And the colors are the first kind of visualization that you see. And the legend, as the legend to the side says, they represent the regions of the world that the languages come from.
Yeah.
So it's giving you a sense already that this is, you know, global, a global microcosm, but you can see clusters of these dots as well. You can see, oh, red dots clustering over there in Queens, purple dots clustering there in Harlem and the Bronx.
Yeah.
And certainly Manhattan is kind of at the center of it. That's how, you know, New York is sort of always mapped. But actually, a lot of the real action here is in what we call the outer boroughs, the other four boroughs, which right. are the places where the most linguistically diverse communities actually have sort of their own worlds, much more so today than Manhattan, which is frankly too expensive to be able to really have, you know, a whole neighborhood of Tagalog speakers or of, you know, speakers of an even much smaller language, for instance. So you'll see a lot of variety in Manhattan, which represents all kinds of things. And we can talk in a second about what these dots all represent. And
yep.
because this is just the sort of front page, as it were. And then, as you said, by clicking on any of the dots or zooming in, I mean, more dots are revealed, but also kind of these stories come up. It is a thematic or storytelling map, as you said. And then you get into, you know, the text, the real kind of ethnographic and qualitative material that tells you, okay, this is actually what's going on at this dot, in this community, at this significant site, at this church, mosque, synagogue, restaurant, community center.
Let's look at some of the areas, because I'm fascinated by, are we still in Brooklyn? If we look at the very dense bunching of red dots, you've got Newari. I mean, I can just go on. You've got Newari.
Queens.
You're into Queens. Yeah, you're into Queens.
So Queens, and maybe I say this because I live in Queens. Queens is perhaps the quintessential area of New York for linguistic diversity. You're looking at a couple of neighborhoods centered on Jackson Heights,
yeah.
which... actually, the late Frederick Wiseman made a movie about Jackson Heights, which is quite wonderful, although it does not capture this linguistic diversity. But if you ask seasoned New Yorkers today, you know, where is the great food? Where's the culture? Where, you know, that sort of beating heart of immigrant New York, there's a good chance they'll say Jackson Heights. Mm. And these colors here kind of reflect particularly that it's a hub for languages of Asia. So as you can see from the legend, we're talking about kind of South Asia in many cases. And people might sort of think of, you know, offhand of Jackson Heights as quote unquote an Indian neighborhood. Actually, it's much more complicated than that. That's part of what this is trying to show. It's not an area where many speakers of Indian languages actually live at this point. To an extent it was, but actually you have large numbers of speakers of Urdu from Pakistan, also of Bengali, which is by far the biggest South Asian language in New York with over 100,000 speakers. But then you also have this whole world of Himalayan languages, which is actually something I've focused on and we focused on here at the Endangered Language Alliance. And many of these dots here, the red dots, are reflecting languages from particular Himalayan valleys in Nepal, in Tibetan areas of China, Bhutan, that have carved out communities here in New York in a sort of extraordinary story just in the last 20 years. And then if you look kind of just to the south of that sea of red dots, you get into an area called Elmhurst, which is really, you know, just as much this kind of area as Jackson Heights is, which is a hub for Southeast Asian languages. Mm-hmm. This is where you'll find, you know, the best Thai food in New York, for instance. And not just speakers of Thai, but speakers of Northern Thai and some minority languages of Thailand. This is where you'll find the relatively new Burmese community, the Indonesian community, where you also will find a number of different languages spoken, not just Indonesian. But then, you know, we shouldn't even just focus on the kind of the red and sort of darker kind of maroon dots, because just sort of to the side of them, you have all these blue dots. That's the area called Corona, which is probably the premier hub for indigenous Latin American languages. That's what the blue is reflecting. And so these worlds are actually side by side.
Absolutely. I mean, I want to take you back to Manhattan because I lived on Henry Street. So we've got that down at the bottom by FDR Drive. And I'm just, again, I was staggered by looking at this because Yiddish is there, which is fine because it's historically a very Jewish area. Then you've got Northern Fujianese. And then to the west, you've got Emiliano. And then you've got Basque. And I go, what? This was not something I was aware of in terms of my encounter with the city. So I'm intrigued at just for you to talk a little bit about the historical impact as well of the layering here of languages. And because you're capturing something there, aren't you, about intense waves of migration. You think, yeah, Yiddish, because there's a history of Jewishness in New York, but you're also describing in places like Queens a much more recent sort of impact of languages.
You have layers from 400 years here. And so in an area like the Lower East Side, which has had successive waves of immigrants and traces are left in all cases. So, you know, when you look at Basque being there, for instance, I mean, that was the heart of Basque New York. Then people moved to Brooklyn. Even the Basque government in exile, believe it or not, during, I think, World War II, was based in New York. And they had an office elsewhere. So you'll see some languages at multiple places. So I think if we click on Basque, we'll see that also you can find other locations. I think notably one in Greenpoint, which is in Brooklyn, which is today where the community center is. And that's a very active space where you can really hear Basque spoken. Whereas the location on the Lower East Side, that reflects an important historical location that was a center for the language. But, you know, in each of these cases, there's kind of a different story. And the approach here was centered, as I kind of touched on briefly, on this idea of significant sites that we had to kind of, you know, you're dealing with either sort of points or polygons when you're trying to map language often. Those are kind of just the brute facts of like, how do you sort of visually represent this? And for a point, you need some kind of, you know, what is the address? What is the location? The verticality of New York is another challenge here. How do you put things on top of each other? Single buildings, as we've documented, can have dozens of languages in them. We don't have a great way of showing that. Likewise, we don't have a great way of showing the sort of diachronic. Ideally, there would be a sort of slider and you could sort of see from 1624 to 2024, you know, what languages were there, were where. But as it is, we just have this kind of classically New York cheek by jowl situation, but also we're hoping to sort of break down, you know, the sort of very simplified picture of here's Little Italy, here's Chinatown, here's, you know, the Yiddish Lower East Side, when in fact you have several Jewish languages on the Lower East Side. So that's why we see Judeo-Spanish and Judeo-Greek. With Chinatown, you see actually there is a distinctively Fujianese area around East Broadway, which is quite different from the original sort of Toisanese area around Columbus Park. And then, of course, there's this large kind of Cantonese zone. Little Italy, I mean, it's actually all these different quote-unquote Italian dialects, which are quite distinct, you know, from Sicily and Naples and southern Italy. So, you know, we wanted to show that. And of course, you know, somebody could say, well, isn't English spoken throughout all of this, or Spanish you could hear everywhere? Of course, we know that. But we are sort of bringing to the fore and highlighting the languages that have otherwise not received any kind of notice.
Ross's passion for protecting and recording the languages of New York is really inspiring. But before we hear more about his work, I'd love for you to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From mapping the cosmos to journeying to the North Pole, we have a wealth of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest, or story from this series or the next. Now, back to the streets of New York. Tell me about Language City, because you take six endangered languages and you try and look at these in terms of their commonality. Why did you choose those speakers, those languages? Tell me a bit about that.
In a way, Language City is almost kind of another product of this map, of the languages of New York City map. It's another way of kind of understanding the city's linguistic diversity, the work of the Endangered Language Alliance, by really sort of bringing out a handful of these stories, half a dozen of these stories that are otherwise, you know, relatively truncated, you know, within the hundreds that we have here. But, you know, these six, which, and I can sort of mention them briefly, but these are the people that we, you know best and have worked with closely for years, have just relationships with, and that, you know, we can say that in different ways, they are finding other, you know, alternate strategies for keeping their languages going in New York. So I can kind of briefly tell, you know, talk about a few of them. An essential one is Karen, who is who just passed away before the book came out, actually about 2 years ago. Who is a reviver. She called herself a language keeper of Lenape, the original language of New York. And it's actually a paradigm case of an endangered language. It has one native speaker left, as far as we know, who's in Canada. This is hundreds of miles from New York City. And actually, Lenape extended not just through what is today New York City, but across a whole section of New York State into the state of New Jersey, the state of Pennsylvania. So we're talking about a major Native American language that, like, you know, there were hundreds of Native American languages here before European settlement. And most of them today are highly endangered if they're still spoken at all. On the other hand, there's been an extraordinary rise of revitalization work, especially with Native American communities on their languages. And Lenape is really an example of that. And Karen is somebody who comes from the Lenape world, comes actually from kind of that same area of Canada where that sort of last native speaker in her 80s is, and learned from the older generation, grew up speaking English. Lenape people in Canada, as well as Oklahoma, are shifting to English. Lenape people were pushed out of New York. That, you know, is part of this story to these distant areas. And eventually, I mean, maintained the language for a long time, have maintained it up to today, but also were under huge pressure to switch to English. So Karen is somebody who is one of these revivers, these people who are, you know, doing the kind of extraordinarily hard work of reviving a language. She was the first person to bring Lenape back to the New York area, part of its original homeland, teaching the language at our center here in Manhattan, the Endangered Language Alliance. So her story kind of, it actually comes at the end, which I think is important, but sort of sets the stage. I mean, Lenape kind of is at the foundation of everything here. Then you have two very different young women who in different ways are finding ways to keep up languages which are still strong in some ways, but increasingly threatened. So one is a speaker of one of those Himalayan languages that I briefly mentioned earlier. This is called Seke. Mm. Her name is Resmina. She may be the youngest speaker of Seke anywhere. She's in her 20s. This is a language that comes originally from five villages of northern Nepal, spoken by about 700 people in total, of whom maybe up to 200 are now in New York, especially in a few buildings in Brooklyn, also to some extent in Queens. So these are almost like vertical villages as I describe them. And I go into a lot of detail in Language City about what this looks like when, you know, a traditional village moves to a vertical village. And then, you know, Resmina documenting her own language, which, like many of the languages we work on, is primarily oral, has not historically been written, and has never really been documented. So all the things that you might expect, dictionary, grammar, books, online presence, these things don't exist for many of the languages we're talking about. So the work that we've done together between Nepal and New York is to document this language in the first place, to create these kind of basic materials for the language.
Tell me about your experience, therefore, of New York and what that means to you, because you talk about yourself as somebody living in the homelands of the Lenape. I experienced, again, that sort of upsurge in an understanding of that history, which I didn't know about until I was living there. How has it changed your sense of New York? And I mean, is there an exceptionalism about the city in terms of that language spread? I mean, there's a kind of cliche of New York as being so diverse in that respect in terms of language, but is it exceptional? Would we find it? I mean, I'm sure I'd probably find it here in London. And how might it change, or how has it changed your sense of your experience of the city?
I think any New Yorker worth their salt has to sort of wrestle with some contradictions. My family has been and stayed in New York since coming through Ellis Island in the great kind of migration wave of the late 19th, early 20th century. And we're fiercely attached to New York. We certainly have all the same kind of brash, bravado, ridiculous, but hopefully lovable, you know, New York exceptionalism. But at the same time, you absolutely, you have to be able to hold in your head at the same time, yes, this is the kind of premier immigrant gateway city of the Americas and in some ways of the world that sort of set the template, which many other cities have now followed in an age of migration, but it is also Lenape land. And those two things are, you know, two sides of the same coin, and they have to be sort of connected and understood together. And then, you know, on the one hand, I mean, this is the, you know, Queens is the same place that gives us Mamdani and Trump. Mm. These are the different sides of New York. This is not all sort of, you know, wonderful. It's not all, you know, a great history of coexistence. There have been, you know, fierce, you know, conflicts around all of this stuff. But I think there's no denying that immigration has, you know, defined New York. It's a fundamental characteristic of the city's history, going back to, you know, the very beginning of its colonial history, which is with the Dutch West India Company. Mm. At a time when the other colonies of kind of North America, British colonies, were essentially kind of English spaces, English only for the most part, this was a place where there were reported to be 18 different languages spoken by the first 400 or so people. Mm. Because it wasn't just a sort of a Dutch colony, it was a company town that was really a multilingual entrepot with, of course, the Native American languages, also the languages of enslaved Africans, which have often been kind of forgotten in all of this, as well as languages spoken by very kind of small, relatively small minority groups from Europe. So the very first settlers to come to New Amsterdam actually were Walloon speakers from this area on the kind of French-Belgian border. It was not a sort of a Dutch monoculture at all.
Yeah.
And that template was set very early on and I think has just continually formed, you know, been part of the city's history.
And you are part of that New York template. I mean, so can we talk a little bit about your heritage and the way in which language and also conflicts, I guess, over language and then fears around loss of language are kind of very personal, I guess, to you in some ways growing up?
I'm a classic figure of that kind of, you know, sort of Ellis Island period or descendant of that period. I didn't come through Ellis Island myself. But it was my great-grandparents or in a few cases, my great-great-grandparents. And they were multilingual Eastern European Jewish immigrants, leaving for all the reasons that, you know, others left, economic, political. And, you know, they were just extraordinary people who were essentially Yiddish mother tongue speakers, as most Eastern European Jews were, but also spoke Polish, Russian, German, you know, figured out English. I mean, and just, you know, this was, and we see this today with immigrant life in New York as well. The most multilingual people who speak 4, 5, 6 languages didn't have it. There's no Duolingo. They don't, you know, university degrees, whatever. They learned it from life and because they had to, and because the least powerful people often have to speak the most languages. If your mother tongue is not a kind of valued dominant language, you have to learn all the others. But then, you know, that the sort of the process kind of ends, you know, goes through sort of my, you know, grandparents and parents of, you know, assimilation, the move towards English, even the loss of really distinctive New York English features, which we could talk about, the sort of local form of English, which comes out of this immigrant melting pot, until I essentially, you know, grew up in Manhattan as a monolingual speaker of a pretty standardized English, as an outcome of that process. And of course that, you know, that represented sort of, you know, class, you know, advance, and it was, you know, push and pull. But at the same time, there was loss there, and there has been for me rediscovery of that kind of trajectory, and I think a reconsideration, as many others have done, of, you know, what is lost if languages run through cities like New York like a sieve, you know, the sort of the knowledge, the abilities, the transnational connections, all the benefits of multilingualism, which we know much more about today. I think that, you know, this, in these ways, yeah, my story, however, you know, kind of paltry compared to the stories I think I tell in the book, is reflective of the story of the immigrant city and does kind of show the continuities of you know, of New York history.
And it takes us to the Endangered Language Alliance. Tell me a bit about your role in that and how and why it was set up.
Well, the other part is that I was a language lover. Mm-hmm. Many out there who, in various ways, try to learn other languages. Maybe have a sense that they didn't, you know, they didn't have that kind of multilingualism at home. So my own way in to the world of linguistic diversity and endangered languages happens actually in China, where I'm, you know, where at the time I was studying Mandarin to learn a big language, but meet this Chinese linguist named Sun Hong Kai, who has, you know, dedicated his life, recently passed away, but dedicated his life to studying the 300 or so, or many of the 300 or so minority languages of China, which people outside, you know, often know very little about. And this kind of opens up for me this world of endangered language documentation, of the need to try to understand and document, you know, this linguistic diversity before it's too late. I come back to New York after this kind of time away, and this place, the Endangered Language Alliance, has been set up really starting in 2010. Daniel Kaufman, my co-director, as well as the linguist Juliette Blevins and a poet, Bob Holman, kind of set up this place, which is really the first organization devoted to urban linguistic diversity in the world, growing out of a recognition that there's a lot that can be done with and for endangered languages in cities.
Because it's interesting that you end up doing this work, but I understand, you know, your PhD and your early research was very much based on field work, more kind of rural field work in China, the border with Tibet, working on the Dictionary of Trung. Tell me a little bit about that experience of that field work. What was it like, and how do you approach dealing with a language which initially you're finding your way into?
Yes, that was the part that I kind of elided when I went from, you know, sort of studying Chinese to coming back to New York. So then there were a bunch of years where I actually followed in the footsteps of this Chinese linguist I just mentioned, Sun Hong Kai, in studying and working on minority languages in China. So I moved to southwest China, to Yunnan province, the most linguistically diverse area within China. It's effectively the Eastern Himalaya, so you're getting that same kind of extraordinary linguistic diversity that you get in places like the Himalayan parts of Nepal and India and Bhutan, Tibet, carries over into southwest China. And, you know, my thinking and understanding at that time, following what I was learning in this field, in this particular kind of part of linguistics, was that there are certain, you know, there's linguistic diversity everywhere, much more than we think, but there are certain hotspots, there are certain parts of the world which, for historical, environmental, topographical reasons, are super diverse. Mm. And the Himalaya is one of them, just as the Caucasus is. I mean, mountain ranges, for obvious reasons, it's a degree of isolation, but also you get critical masses of people in mountain valleys who are able to form their own cultures. They're relatively impervious to some of the empires and nation states that tend to squash languages. Islands are also extraordinary. If you get both islands and mountains, then you're off to the races. Look at Papua New Guinea. This is a famous kind of linguistic hotspot in the world. So I was kind of in that sort of world in the Eastern Himalaya and doing what, you know, was in a way the kind of classic field work of on a little documented language, working on this particular language, Trung, spoken in one particular valley, kind of trying to do the three-part task as part of a PhD, a very kind of remote, distant sort of PhD, because it was very based on field work. You know, writing coming up with a grammar of the language. That's the really sort of academic part. What are all the sort of the rules and tendencies that you need to know to kind of explain how the language works? A dictionary, which is something more ultimately community oriented and that people perhaps can understand. But lexicography is really an art unto itself. So this was a trilingual Trung Chinese English dictionary, which, again, you know, ate up sort of years of life. It was produced together with three Trung speakers and thinkers, and then a set of texts, a corpus of stories, songs, conversations, oral histories that actually show the language in action, transcribed as much as possible, translated as well, with, you know, kind of analysis also of how each kind of bit and bob is working. So that was, you know, probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. There were sort of years of that work, and then the sort of return to New York with that kind of experience in mind, but understanding and seeing, you know, these others who had just created the Endangered Language Alliance, that actually you could do this work in cities as well, in a different way, that this would not be kind of field work thousands of miles from home, but actually a kind of day in, day out, kind of give and take with speakers in urban and diaspora settings, which has a set of its own challenges, which are fascinating, but that, you know, urbanization and diasporization are facts of life everywhere on the planet. And so we need to know what's happening with languages in cities. Cities need to have a future. Languages need to have a future in cities. And so it's been a matter of kind of transferring, rethinking, and sort of drawing on a lot of the work that I was doing in that kind of traditional fieldwork setting for an urban context. Although I should also say that kind of traditional field work still very much has a place when possible. And I do talk in Language City about going with some of the speakers who are profiled, Rasmina to Nepal, Husnia, who's the Wahi speaker that I talk about, going to Tajikistan to work with her on the languages in that area. So actually here at the Endangered Language Alliance, we often do kind of work between New York and these kind of far-flung places where the language originally comes from.
And is there a wider issue here with the problems of AI and globalization online? Because, you know, I can go to many of these places, say in areas like the Himalayas, and I can, if I've got signal, I can use a translation app. And there is that process, it seems to me, globally, that we don't need to learn languages anymore. I mean, that's the kind of terrible outcome, it seems, of some of those moves online. Is that another form of endangered languages? I mean, what are we losing there, Ross? What's your sense of that move online and using AI tools to just be able to hear what anybody's saying?
The question concerning technology is a very pressing and complicated one for us, because we use a lot of technology in our work. Not just recording technology, but software to analyze and work with the materials, to archive them, disseminate them, various platforms online. Thus far, AI specifically cannot sort of touch or know, does not know much about most of the languages that we're talking about here. So we've had a little breathing room. Hmm. And you could say that also, you know, speakers of larger languages have essentially never learned these languages either. So the kind of catastrophic and sort of terrible drop that you see, for instance, in, you know, the number of people learning German in the United States, and I'm sure, I think there's similar things for the UK, and most languages, as you say, language learning, the question of, you know, the question of language learning, in a way, it doesn't get quite applied to most of these languages because nobody has really learned them outside of the communities to begin with. Mm. But that said, certainly these developments are starting to come for smaller indigenous, minority, and endangered languages. And there really is the question, as with every technology, as to how the technologies will be used, whose sort of data is kind of feeding into these systems. You know, I mean, there's very basic questions with just writing down many of these languages, because they're, as I say, primarily oral. So even just from that, there's, you know, AI and the internet don't really sort of know about them or have much to do with them at this point.
Right.
And so some people are hopeful, oh, can it, you know, AI save endangered languages? I've written a piece on this kind of very question. It's not a salvation by any means. Yeah. And there are a lot of kind of issues that as you say, could sort of drive further endangerment or give people a sense, oh, okay, it's preserved, AI knows it. So there's a lot of interesting opportunities right now. There's also some very serious threats coming from a number of directions, but including technology. So it's watch this space, I guess.
Well, I wonder if that space is connected to what I wanted to ask you about when I came across the description of your next book, because this is very intriguing and I wondered if it's relevant to what we've just talked about. The title, I believe, is The Jesus Film on Universal Translation, Endangered Languages and Holy Writ in the Age of AI. Ross, that's quite a title. can you tell us a bit about the project?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Subtitles have really gotten out of control in the English language publishing world.
Oh, I don't know. I think it's a great one.
Thanks. No, it's a working title. We'll see what, and we're still kind of in the early stages, but there are a few elements building off our conversation that this book hopefully will kind of tackle. One is that an extraordinary amount of the kind of language documentation work and interest in language diversity that we've been talking around comes not from kind of academic or academic adjacent linguists like myself or those of us at the Endangered Language Alliance, but from missionaries, especially Christian missionaries who are working to translate the Bible.
Yeah.
Or parts of the Bible as embodied in this particular film, which I'm looking at, which is kind of an extraordinary story unto itself. So stay tuned. But essentially, you have, you know, a lot of this material, a lot of the material you'll find online, one of those major databases I mentioned, these are driven by a kind of religious goal known as the Great Commission, which is the idea that the gospel needs to be in every language. So mm-hmm. this actually is driving forward kind of understanding of the world's languages more than, more than almost anything else. And in that sense, it intersects with AI, because when the programmers or creators of the large language models are looking for data to train on, most of what they find is religious material translated by the missionaries or by kind of new Christians in these communities. Mm. So it's this kind of intersection. I don't know if it's an apocalypse, a good one or a bad one, but a kind of planetary linguistic event, the first planetary linguistic event, as I think of it, that we're sort of approaching, where we are kind of finally understanding the depth of human linguistic diversity. And it's kind of the things that are really driving it in a way are, you know, the technologies and this religious impulse. And then cities like New York, in a way, are kind of where it all comes together. So just as, you know, cities like New York and London are places where the world's languages are converging, they're also kind of converging in a very different sense on the single text of the Bible and in AI.
Well, thank you for bringing us right back to the map that we started with on the languages of New York City. Ross, it's been fascinating to go through that map with you. As I say, as somebody who knows the city or thought they knew the city and the languages spoken there, it's been an absolute revelation. It's an absolute pleasure to have been speaking to you. Ross Perlin, thank you so much for joining me on What's Your Map?
Thanks. Likewise, Jerry. A real pleasure.
As a historian, I'm amazed by the layering of languages that's been going on in New York for over 400 years, and very moved to hear about the work that's being done to record and preserve such fragile languages like Lenape. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland collection and send suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com.